Thank you so much, Moshe. Good evening, and hello, Jamaica State. It's so good to be back. I'm going to adjust the mic. It's really good to be back. I want to thank John in absentia, John Kramer, for putting it all together. He always reaches out at some point and gets me all excited, and then it's just a matter of timing, logistics, making it all work, and voila, here we are. I also, again, want to thank Rabbi Hochberg, who has been such a wonderful and gracious host. I'm sorry that all of them seem to be having happy occasions. So we're going to have to do things on our own over here tonight. So Megillat Esther, I'll tell you, we've been having this Ketuvim quest. Every single time I come out here, we say, okay, let's pick something from Ketuvim, because let's face it, they're less studied than the first sections of the Bible on average. But then Megillat Esther rolls in, and Esther is a different bird, because Megillat Esther is easily one of the most familiar texts that we have going for us. And I warned John that there's only one way that I know how to do this. I've trialed and erred with a lot of error for quite some time on the Megillat Esther front, and I can't think of any other way to go about doing this. So I'll give you a little background. I usually don't give you a personal anecdote to begin the shiur, but I just want to make you all feel really uneasy. That's really all that this is going to be. So this is now my 45th semester teaching Tanakh at Yeshiva University. I started when I was 3 years old or so, I suppose. But anyway, so it's a while, and so back in my fourth semester was the very first time I got to teach Megillot. Well, oh boy, was somebody around here very excited. I tend to get very excited about this. I'm sure those of you who have been here before might have picked that up. If you haven't, you may pick it up tonight. So I was gung-ho. I prepared all summer. I had some fabulous stuff. You know, my very first maiden voyage going through the Megillot at an advanced level. I was very, very excited about it. And a thing about me, which some of you might know, I never stop preparing. Preparing is kind of a thing that you just do, and you keep going until the moment that you give that shiur, and then you keep preparing afterwards, and okay, I wish I had read some of that stuff before, but that's impossible, so too bad, you do the best you can, and you know that next time it will be better. Okay, so semester kicked off, and I was doing root first, and Esther was on deck. And I had some really fantastic stuff that I prepared all summer. It was like a lifetime of distillation of material. I couldn't wait to get up there and do it. All right, so the semester goes on, and I keep reading, because that's what you do. You just keep reading and reading and reading. And then, just about a week or two before Esther got on the air, I read one article, 12 pages long, in Hebrew, short and sweet. And I read it. I thought a little bit about it. I said, you know, better read this one again. Read it again. I'm like, oh my, this is interesting. You know, a lot of learning, those of you who have glasses know exactly what I'm talking about, right? It's a lot of these, so what do you see more clearly, A or B, right? I've done that thousands of times myself. And most of learning is like that. Most of learning, you have a sense of what it is, and then hopefully you learn something different, and it gives you a slightly clearer picture. All right, well, this article was laser surgery. It wasn't that I had a slight tweak on what I was going to say. I realized that everything that I had on my notes and on my computer, ready to go a week from then, was without any basis whatsoever. Okay, so what you do in this situation is you do what you have to do. I deleted everything. And then what you also do, if you're me, I happen to be an incredibly transparent teacher, I just trooped into class, and I said, okay guys, here's the situation. I thought I had all this great stuff to teach you. Last week I read an article that changed my mind about everything I ever thought about Megillat Esther. And I had to delete everything I was going to do. And now it's Megillat Esther time, and we're going to have to scramble. And that's what we did. We scrambled, we did our absolute best, knowing that, okay, there's nothing I can do about it this semester, but by next time I'll get it straight, and lo and behold, that gave me a chance to iron out a lot of the things that we had. So going back to what we need to do to make this work, I know no other way to do it. Tonight, all we're going to do is ask a lot of questions. That's really it. Because I can't think of any other good way to do it. If I start presenting material and going through the text, there's simply a lot of baggage. It's not your fault. It's not my fault. It's yeshiva education just about anywhere I could think of. So I teach students from all over the country, and I have no idea where they went or where they're from or what yeshivot they went to. But I know exactly what I'm up against. And so to make this work, we're simply going to ask a bunch of questions tonight. And then next week, I promise you, It will be for the sake of productive. I'm not interested in knocking anybody's assumptions down for the sake of knocking it down. There's even a halachic category of this, right? It's soter, on the not leave note. Right? The idea is that to be constructive labor by knocking down a building, you're doing it in order to build a better building afterwards. And that's what this is really all going to be about. And of course, as a fun thing that you gained, that people who missed tonight but will be here next week will find out, you'll see who wasn't here. You'll be able to tell from their questions next week. And we'll say, well, if you come here last week, you'll be able to know how we reckoned with you. You'll see. It really actually works out that way. There's nothing I can do about that. Hopefully they will all get to listen to it online, depending on how quickly these things get posted online. So without further ado, I'm simply going to ask a bunch of questions. That's really all tonight is going to be. But you better come back next week, because otherwise you'll just have a lot of questions and you won't know what to do with them. Whereas I have a plan. It's simply a two-week process, and there's no other way to do it. So let me just toss out some questions, and you tell me what you know. And remember, I have only one question on my mind whenever we do any of these things, which is, what does a divinely inspired text want to tell us? And in the case of Megillat Esther, you'll see, this is harder to ascertain than, say, what we did last time a couple of years ago, Ezra Nehemiah. Ezra Nehemiah, we just dealt with the text, sorted out the major issues and themes. We were good for the go. Here it's trickier because we know a lot. And when you know a lot, that actually can be good. I'm all in favor of knowledge, but it also can really, really potentially get in the way. And we'll see where we are. Question number one. So how are the Jews depicted in Megillat Esther? Tell me everything you know. How are they? Are they good? Are they not so good? What's their state? Tell me everything you know. Yeah, go crazy.
Well, I don't have to go crazy, but I think that they seem to be assimilated in the way that they are willing to go to the king's palace and drink the wine that he has there. And even though the king is using the influence from Beit HaMikdash, that they're still there and they're celebrating with him.
Okay, I mean, I'm going to say excellent to you, not excellent in terms of what you just said. It's not your fault. That's terrible, right? But what you said is, excellent. So they're assimilated, they're in the party, which is celebrating the Klei Beit HaMikdash over there. Terrible. Okay, good. Next. Okay, good.
There's actually nothing in the text that speaks of the Jewish people.
Nothing at all.
Nothing at all. As I'm going through, there's nothing. I mean, we see that Esther says, gather all the people together to fast. We don't know if they respond, but, she assumes that they would be swayed by the leadership of Mordechai. There's really nothing there in the text. It's all the Rashi that's all about.
Okay, I'm asking about the text.
In the party.
Good, good, good. Okay, so nothing at all. A different kind of vote. Okay, good.
I wouldn't say that all the Jews assimilated, because you have Mordechai, who was, although he stayed by the house, but he must have been more learned, he was doing the right thing, it appears, of his own heroes.
Yeah, I named my son Mordechai. I'm all pro Mordechai. Yeah, absolutely. So you could say
all.
Correct. When we say all, but okay, fine. So I give you that point right away, and I'm sure that even she would agree with you, right? That even if the Jews are assimilationist and celebrating, that doesn't mean that Mordechai is on board with that, right?
But there might have been others than Mordechai.
Huh? There may be other good people among them. Absolutely. Okay, good. Yes.
This is the Ur text for anti-Semitism, the name of Zar Mufarad.
So how are you translating that? Good.
They're spread out, they're dispersed, and different.
Okay, dispersed and different. Good. Carry on. Anything else? Yes.
Jews of Shushan were, I guess, terrified, but it says that here, Shushan and Hamothas, and then you're terrified at the time of the decree.
Definitely true. I don't blame them. But
it's the Jews of Shushan. I can't say that the rest of Jews in the area.
Fair enough. I mean, the empire is enormous. You're absolutely correct. The Jews of Shushan certainly found out first, just because they were where the action was. But it even says that as the decree got out, people also panicked, which I understand. You wouldn't panic in India until you knew the decree was there. But once the decree is there, then Jews also got nervous. I think it's fair to say that Jews were afraid. But what does that say about their religious state, if anything? Nothing really. In other words, you could be incredibly assimilated and still be terrified by this, or you can be incredibly unassimilated and say this also. Good. So we have here a wide diversity of opinions. I think that that's fair. Mordechai definitely seems to get good billing. I like that. I'm all pro Mordechai. In terms of the Jews' status, we have ranging from we really don't know very much at all, to they are scattered and somehow stand out in some way or another, to they are very assimilated and participate in the party. So let me just tell you what it says in the text. And correct me, just because I say this doesn't mean anything. Just you feel free to shoot me to smithereens. And the Jews, this is actually this is something that I celebrate, because this isn't always the case if you read Tanakh. The Jewish people are cast as uniformly positive in Megillat Esther. They are absolutely good. There's not a trace of negativity about them whatsoever. Okay, so it's important to just put together the text evidence. It's more, the text does say something about them. It doesn't say nothing. It says quite a bit, actually. First of all, when Esther calls on them to fast, they all fast. The Jews are unbelievably united, and here's something that you don't see every day in Tanakh. They listen to their leaders. Right? I mean, you ask the Nevi'im on a regular basis, what do? When you talk to the people, you're hoping that one or two people might listen to you or at least not spit on you, okay? The Nevi'im have a really tough day. Well, Mordechai and Esther, when they ask the Jews to do things, the Jews do things. It's really actually very impressive. When the Jews celebrate, they're actually the ones who invent the holiday, and Mordechai and Esther ratify the holiday. And the holiday is very chesed-driven. It's really very impressive. The Jews were permitted to plunder their adversaries. They got express permission in Mordechai's decrees to plunder their enemies. And yet, the Megillah bends over backwards to say that not a single Jew took a dime. It was a war of self-defense, and nobody wanted to benefit whatsoever. In fact, the most interesting testament, I don't want to put too much stock in this, the most interesting testament is what you said before, actually, but it's even better than that, to the Jews' religiosity is Haman's accusation. If you look at source number 2 over here, I'm going to read it in English, but you have the Hebrew right in front of you also. Haman then said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the other peoples in all the provinces of your realm, whose laws are different from those of any other people, and who do not obey the king's laws. It is not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them." Haman's accusation is that the Jews keep to themselves, that the Jews are faithful to their laws and don't keep the laws of Persia. Now again, I don't want to overrate Haman's accusation because he has an agenda and he's a pretty evil man. All the same, his one accusation against the Jews is that they're faithful and not regular Persians who have assimilated into the dominant Persian majority. One Midrash picks up on this, by the way, in source 3. "However Haman accused Israel below is how Michael defended them above." He's our guardian angel defending us whenever wicked people try to go after the Jews. "Michael said, 'Master of the universe, your children are not being accused of idolatry or adultery or murder, but rather they are accused for observing your laws.'" That's a great defense. So here's one midrash where they plug it into Michael's mouth that, look, the Jews are good. And in fact, the Jews are absolutely good in the Megillah. The biggest sign of Jewish assimilation in the entire Megillah, which is meaningless, is Mordechai's name. It's a totally pagan name. I'll tell that to my son one day, but not yet. First, let's teach him the story. He's 3. And then we'll roll around to, you know, the name is just from Marduk, the Babylonian patron deity, which became a Jewish name because of our story. In other words, the hero of our Megillah suddenly turned it into a Jewish name for us, which is great. Love it. But its origins are quite pagan. But this hardly suggests that Mordechai or anybody else was assimilated in the least. So the Jews are cast as absolutely positive with no negative at all. Just to make sure that that is clear. Now, in terms of the party, just to make sure that this point gets across, because I learned that too when I was a kid. This is simply false. Okay, just to make it straightforward. Megillat Esther has no interest whatsoever in Jewish participation in either party. If it cared about this issue, it would talk about it. Right? Ahasuerus throws 2 parties. The first party is 180 days long for all the governors of the 127 provinces. How many total Jews were at that first party? 1, 2, 0, I don't know. There's no reason to think that any Jews participate in the first party at all. It wasn't for the empire. It was for the notables of the empire. So whoever happened to have been Jewish, okay, fine. But odds are high, the population of Jews in the first party for 180 days was very close to zero. And then there was the party for Shushan. Okay, so here Jews presumably participated. But so, what's wrong with that? If the king invites you, wouldn't you go? There's nothing in the Megillah suggesting that Ahasuerus is celebrating the non-rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. There's nothing suggesting that there's anything anti-Jewish about the party at all. Why does Ahasuerus throw his party? Why does he throw his party, according to the Megillah?
Because the prophecy didn't come true after 70 years.
Doesn't say that.
Esther.
Power. Power and glory and wealth. In other words, he was just a good old regular king doing what emperors do. Now that's all it says. Read it again. Read chapter 1 of Megillat Esther. There is nothing about the Beit HaMikdash. There's nothing about the Jews in chapter 1. Zero. It's really just about the king's wealth and power and glory. He does a swell job. He impresses, I'm sure, everybody. And people come. There is no reason to think that there was anything negative about participating in this party at all. In fact, we would have gone. We wouldn't have eaten the not kosher food. But we would have gone and showed face. We would have gotten photo ops with the emperor. Because that's what you do. Right? Megillat Esther doesn't mention whatsoever the Jews at all in that chapter because it's not relevant to the message of the Megillah. Okay. So, let's read the Talmudic passage and the utensils of the Beit HaMikdash. I'm aware of the Talmud also, and tune in next week, we're going to talk about that. Because the Talmud, you will find, has its finger on the pulse of every single important theme of Megillat Esther. But if you think that those passages are in the Megillah, then you fail the Megillah and you fail the Talmud. So what we have to do is just keep them separate. That's what tonight is about. And then next week we can talk about what the Megillah really says. And then talk about how the Talmud really has its finger on the pulse of all of it. It's really cool. But that's next week. For this week, here's an important feature of the Megillah which we just need to know. Ahasuerus was not in possession of the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash. And Chazal knew that. Okay? How do I know that Ahasuerus was not in possession of the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash? Because Sefer Ezra, which we talked about 2 years ago, chapter 1, which occurred before the Megillah, Cyrus the Great returned the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash to the Jewish community when they were going back. So the Jews have them in Jerusalem right now. That's where they are. That's where they belong. Chazal knew that. Chazal knew Ezra chapter 1 much better than I will ever know it. Chazal were trying to hit on something much more important, and that's what next week will be about. But they didn't have, Ahasuerus did not have the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash. And this is Ve'kelim Yechelim Shonim. What does it mean? What do you think it means? He was a wealthy king. You know what, folks? He had a lot of sets of silverware. If you've ever been to the mansions in Newport, Rhode Island, that's shot in Mikhailim Mikhailim Shonim. I took a tour once. I was a terrible tourist. I'm not really ashamed. No, I felt pretty good about it. I felt tragic. The sense of, you know, the tour guide was going on about how this and that mansion owner had 76 sets of silverware. Now I'm thinking, okay, no dairy, no parv, no meat, no Pesach. Why? Right? And then up goes my hand. I asked, you know, the tour guide was very proud of all of this information. I said, okay, granting that these people were very wealthy and were spending a lot more money than they needed to, were any of them also involved in philanthropy? I was just curious. I said, okay, fine. Granting that they're throwing away a lot of money on silverware, but did they also build hospitals or fight disease or help the poor, do something with their zillions of dollars? At which point the tour guides tended to get really uncomfortable. And the answer generally was it wasn't in fashion then. Oh, sorry. Okay, so that's the Kelim Mechilim Shonim. That's all Ahasuerus has. That's all the Megillah says. He was incredibly wealthy. What do you expect? He's the richest man in the world. And okay. So it was a very lavish party. That's all Megillat Esther wants to say about the party. Yeah.
But so why is that read in a more full tone?
Ah, very good. So the custom to read it to Megillat Echa, which many Jews have the custom, including what you are referring to, is based on the Talmudic passage that links it to the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash. But Chazal knew that that was not a factual point. Chazal knew that they were trying to teach something much more important. So you're absolutely right. What Chazal are saying, they knew Ezra chapter 1. They knew that the Kelim are in Yerushalayim, where they belong. But Chazal are trying to teach something way more important, and that's part of what next week is going to be about. Okay, so here's the passage that people often quote when they talk about the party. So let's just look at it inside, because you will see that the very passage that is used to talk about how the party demonstrates negative actually rejects itself, and somehow we don't learn it that way in school. Go figure. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was asked by his disciples. You imagine Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, one of the leading Tanaim of that time, is giving shiur about Megillat Esther. So his students ask him, why were the enemies of Israel, which is a polite way of saying, why did Israel in that generation deserve extermination? In other words, why did the Jews deserve destruction? He said to them, answer the question. Okay, so Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, rather than answering them as the Rebbe, he says, why don't you give an answer? They said, because they partook of the feast of that wicked one. They went to the party. Voila. He said to them, well, that's just wrong. If so, those in Shushan should have been killed, but not those in the other provinces. In other words, this answer is false. Don't forget, Jews of the world did not participate in either party, which is his point. So if you're saying the entire Jewish community of the world deserved destruction, that's simply not fair. Only Jews of Shushan participated in either party, and how could you blame the Jews of India for that? So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai rejects the party answer right here in the very passage that people use as a proof text, and then that's it. The answer is now hereby refuted. They don't come back and defend it. They then said, answer the question. He said to them, it was because they bowed down to the image. They bowed down to some idol. What idol? Huh?
The one on Haman.
The one on Haman. Okay, so read the Megillah again. Anybody see any idols in there? Nothing doing. There's no idols in Megillat Esther at all. Yes, the Persians were pagan people. But paganism seems to play zero role in the story, which is really curious given that we are dealing with a pagan empire. But there's no idols in Megillat Esther at all. In fact, Rashi doesn't think that it's referring to Haman at all. Rashi thinks that the image refers to three generations ago, the wicked king Nebuchadnezzar, the destroyer of the temple, he put out a real golden idol in Babylonia and forced Jews to, well, forced everybody to bow to it. And some Jews were there, and some Jews presumably bowed. So Rashi doesn't think that it's about anything in the Purim story. He thinks that since the Jews are doing nothing wrong in the Megillah at all, okay, so let's project this back three generations where some Jews sinned. Okay, some Jews may have sinned then, but to blame Mordechai's generation because of three generations ago is an astonishing claim. And they end up saying, well, they say to him, well, then why did God forgive them if they really deserve to be destroyed? He replied, they only pretended to worship Ah, they didn't really mean it anyway, and he also only pretended to exterminate them. So it is written, for he afflicted not from his heart. In other words, according to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, God never meant this anyway. It was just to frighten the Jews for worshiping this idol, not meaning it anyway. Let's summarize everything. Why are Chazal asking this question in Masachet Megillah in Source 4? What are they driving at? What's their question? What motivates them here? What do they ask at the very beginning? What's motivating this whole conversation? Why do the Jews deserve it? And the reason why they need to answer this question is because Megillat Esther, of course, does not give any answer at all to that question. Right? Megillat Esther doesn't tell us that the Jews sinned and deserve this. There are plenty of biblical books that do that sort of thing. Not this one. There's no sin. The Jews are good. In fact, I would even say the Jews are fantastic. Not only that, but Megillat Esther doesn't even pretend to give a theological cause behind Haman's decree. There are three reasons in the Megillah why this decree happens. What are they? None of them are theological. Yeah? Haman is wicked, yes. Number one. In fact, I would even make that number one in a family feud sort of thing. Mordechai doesn't bow down. That's number two. And there's one other reason, which often gets overlooked, by the way, and we'll have to talk about that more next week, but let's mention it now. So far we have two of the three right there. Haman is wicked. Mordechai refused to bow to Haman. Had Mordechai bowed, then there's no story. Okay? One other part, that there would be no story were it not for this person's input. The Jews don't blend in, but you're right. That's secondary, though. In other words, had Mordechai bowed, right, then Haman wouldn't care. The only reason Haman gets so set off is because besides being wicked, he's also one really sick guy, right? So you're right. Once he's angry at Mordechai, he decides to go after the whole people who stand out. But it's not the Jews' fault, according to the Megillah, for the decree. It's Mordechai triggered this, and don't blame him for the whole thing. Haman is wicked. But here's one that, don't let go of this point. If Ahasuerus would have said, sorry, we don't commit genocide in my empire, well, then there's no story either. Right? Ahasuerus accepted Haman's bribe. Had he not accepted the bribe and said, sorry, we're a law-abiding empire here, then Haman is done. In fact, Haman likely can lose his life or at least his job over such a petition. But since Ahasuerus isn't that nice, he's got problems of his own, which we'll talk about more next week, that helps make the story go round. If he would have simply said no, then there is no story. So to summarize what we have, assimilation is bad. I'm against it myself. And all those midrashim that talk about the Jews as assimilationists, based on nothing whatsoever in the text, they're still good lessons, and very important lessons that we need to hear in this day and age as much as ever, right? But there's nothing in Megillat Esther about the Jews being assimilated, or negative. They're all perfectly, purely good. That's point number one. Okay, point number two is that even though the Jews are perfectly positive and only positive, we really don't know how observant they are at all. There is nothing about Shabbat, Kashrut, Torah, and here's the biggest one of them all, which you all know, God, in the Megillah. Where did God go? How come God appears zero times in Megillat Esther? What kind of biblical book is this? It's very weird, right? You should know that in the Second Temple period, you know, the Jews translated the Tanakh into Greek, what we colloquially call the Septuagint, right? All right, so in the Greek translation of the Megillat Esther, it's what they call Farteisht and Farbesert, right? It's translated, but it is significantly augmented. So, for example, you know when Esther is about to enter the throne room? There's a massive prayer that she says in the text in the Greek. And guess what? God's name appears a lot in there. When Mordechai learns of the decree, he prays plenty to God, which is exactly what you and I might expect of him. So when you add all of this up, God's name in the Greek appears more than 50 times, 5-0. In other words, the translators didn't just want to translate this into Greek, because then it's still a problem. Where did God go? All right, so let's just add a whole lot of stuff and make it sound religious. Because that is so conspicuously missing. It's really weird, right? And you know this, I know this, we all know this. It's really weird. We don't know a thing about Jewish observance, and we can't figure out why it is such a patently not religious sounding book. And it gets more than that. I mean, Megillat Esther is one of two books in Tanakh that doesn't have God's name. The other is Shir HaShirim. But we can easily come up with more religious-sounding reasons for why God's name does not appear in Shir HaShirim, including if there is some allegorical, metaphorical layer to the meaning. Well, you don't want to have God's name explicitly in there because then it can't be a metaphor to God. It doesn't work, right? So by leaving God's name out, you're actually able to do that. Megillat Esther simply is weird. The Torah is not mentioned. Nothing covenantal is mentioned at all. The holiday at the end, you and I celebrate it as a religious holiday, but in Megillat Esther, since God is nowhere, God is not there either. It could have been a nationalistic holiday. You could be the most assimilated person in the world and still celebrate not being dead. And you could still do chesed one to the other. Right? There's nothing specifically religious in the way that you and I think about it anywhere in the Megillah. Best example, this is just too weird for words. Okay, I don't know if it's weirder than God's name not being there, but it's close. You know, when the Jews fast, all right, you go through Tanakh. When people fast, you know what they always do? They always pray. That's always what you do when you fast, because that's sort of the point. All right, Megillat Esther, they fast and there's no mention of prayer. That's so weird. I mean, what's up with the non-prayer thing? And it's like, of course you're praying. Like, you would think the Jewish people are praying. They're in dire straits here. That's why they're fasting, right? Nothing. No mention of prayer, because since God is completely extirpated from everything, okay, so he's not there. So we have to figure this out. We have a lot of things to figure out for next week. But let me ask the next question. So Mordechai doesn't bow, right? Why not? Why doesn't he just bow and save us all the trouble? Yeah?
The magic hand has to have something on the
there's a midrash that he has an idol that Haman, I mean, he was like a great outreach guy, right? I don't think of Haman that way. I don't think of him as a humble, religious pagan. I think of him as a seriously flawed, wicked, and very egotistical sort of guy. All the same, there's a midrash that plugs in that he's wearing an idol. But in the text of Megillat Esther, what's going down? Why does Mordechai refuse to bow? Isn't that weird? That's like the whole story is riding on this. And you know, the idol thing makes sense, because why in the world else isn't he doing this, right? But you see, Megillat Esther doesn't say that. And not only does it not say that, it seems to bend over backwards, not to say anything meaningful at all. And that's what's so weird, right? Mordechai, if you look at source 6 over here, here's the whole story. You can look at it yourself. All the king's courtiers in the palace gate knelt and bowed low to Haman, for such was the king's order concerning him. But Mordechai would not kneel or bow low. Then the king's courtiers who were in the palace gate said to Mordechai, "Why do you disobey the king's order?" And they spoke to him day after day. He would not listen to them. They told Haman, in order to see whether Mordechai's resolve would prevail, for he had explained to them that he was a Jew. So why didn't he bow exactly?
Jews don't bow down.
Huh?
Jews don't bow down to people.
Jews don't bow down to people, but why not? And especially if you're going to die.
Yeah, but I won't bow down to a pagan guy. Right?
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with bowing down to people. It's okay. I don't go out of my way to bow to people on a regular basis, but. What's wrong with it? It's the king's high official. You bow down to the king, you bow down to the king's high officials when they order you to bow down. By the way, just a visual thing. This really bothers me, but it's right anyway, so just deal with it. My picture, like I imagine many of us, is that we picture, you know, as Haman is bumbling along in the king's courtyard, Mordechai is standing there defiant, you know, standing tall, sticking his tongue out if need be, whatever it's going to take, looking, obviously, you know, despising this wicked, horrible guy. Right? Now that picture, as much as I like it, is just plain wrong. Based on what we just read, what does it say here? That is very clearly not what happened. As much as I love that picture, and the artists often do too, but it's just simply not correct. Yeah?
The question that you're making me think, what would you say the Divrei Mordechai are? Because I like your English that says that he gives what means he explained to them, given the reason it seems, you know, in this pasuk for the action, the inaction, the previous one, why he didn't bow. But it seems that there may be something else going on. I am doing the Divrei Mordechai, he didn't have a shahu yu vi. What are these words? Did he respond? What are these?
Dunno?
There seems to be something.
Yeah, there seems to be something going on. I agree with you. For sure, yeah.
It also doesn't appear that all the citizens bowed down to Hamar. Was there only the Abdei HaMelech or Yishev Yishar HaMelech?
This is absolutely right.
And Mordechai was not one of the Abdei HaMelech or Sarai HaMelech.
Correct, so far as we know.
Right, he's just an ordinary guy.
He's an ordinary man who's positioned in the king's courtyard because he's looking out for Esther already. Correct. It's important to note this just in general. Whenever people blame the Jews for being assimilated because everybody bowed to Haman, that's even less accurate than going to the party. Right? Because the only people who have to bow to Haman are a very small percentage of the people of Shushan. Right? It's only the king's officers in the king's gate. There might be zero Jews there. Right? There's no reason to think that the entire Jewish people are bowing to Haman at all. Right? So that's correct.
It's also not 100% clear that the king gave that order to them. The king gave Haman the authorization. The king said it to Haman.
Pertaining to him. I mean, in other words...
But
I'm saying that's what it means in this context. It means that everybody understood when Haman goes through, the king has ordered that everybody must bow to Haman. Everybody got it. But by the way, going back to the artist's thing, why is that incorrect? Because Haman didn't see Mordechai not bowing. It took days. Right? It took days for the king's courtiers to figure out that something was going on. So presumably what happened? Haman came around every day at 10 o'clock. First day, Mordechai is not there. Okay, he's moving his car. Right? Second day, he's not there. All right, maybe he has a dentist appointment. But by the third, fourth, fifth day, and Mordechai is always in the king's courtyard except at 10 o'clock. All right, so that triggers to the courtiers. Something's going on, so they start to chit-chat with him. Hey, Mordechai, why are you never here at 10 o'clock? And Mordechai says, oh, you know, I'm Jewish, and he doesn't really explain himself, and you're right, there's more going on here than whatever he tells them. And then finally, the courtiers go and tell Haman about this. Meaning Haman had no clue that Mordechai was refusing to bow. He only knows about it because the courtiers, after several days of figuring this out, told on him. Okay, so the scene isn't a defiant Mordechai. The point is that Mordechai simply absented himself conspicuous to the people sitting next to him. And eventually, everybody put two and two together and eventually reported this to Haman. Then Haman noticed. Yes?
Do you think that they're saying that he's not bad because he's Jewish, or they're just watching?
It doesn't even say that his Jewishness is why he refuses to bow. He lets him know, you know, by the way, who are you? Oh, I'm Jewish, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't necessarily mean that his Jewishness is why he's not bowing. Right? We just know that he refuses to bow. I have no clue why. Zero. And he happens to be Jewish, which is an important part of his identity in the whole Megillah, not just in this scene. And that's something which they find out and report to Haman, which, of course, triggers the decree. Yes?
I'm just wondering,
what do you think?
You know, obviously there's something that Mordechai is aware of that maybe the other officers are not. The fact that Esther has a significant, you know, position in that kingdom, that's her uncle, and maybe she's tipping him off.
So this could be. I mean, one thing that...
I'm just asking. I don't know.
Yeah. One thing that I wonder, does Mordechai know now what we quickly find out, which is that Haman is really wicked? If he already knows that now, meaning prior to the decree against the Jews, by then it's pretty clear to everybody, but if Mordechai already knows that, whether because Esther is tipping him off or just because he knows him, then that might be one of the reasons why he refuses to bow, because he knows that Haman is a very bad man. Right, so that might, so then inside information may contribute to that, don't know. Yeah.
I have a question. Who was Mordechai in the first place to get so close to the palace and Achshverosh? And, like, why is he there? Who is he that he was so prominent to be so close to the emperor and the king and everybody?
Correct. So the answer is, I don't know how, what kind of, you know, credentials you need to be able to go to the king's courtyard back then, because he wasn't the king's officer so far as we know, but he is Esther's cousin. So the Megillah...
But he brings Esther into this. Why was he there in the first place?
Well, he wasn't in the king's courtyard until Esther won the contest, and now he realizes he has to look out for her. Right, so then he decides to get buddy-buddy with all the different officers, and he's nearby to try to keep a finger on the pulse of what's happening with his cousin Esther in the palace.
But just Joe Schmo can't get his cousin to be, you know...
Oh, this isn't a Protexia thing. She was really pretty. That's all the Megillah says. Right? It's not because of Protexia or nobility or relatives, nothing. She just won the beauty contest. It took the king 4 years to decide that she was the one. Right? So... I don't think very highly of Achashverosh. We'll go into detail on that next week. But that's all it is. There's nothing about Mordechai's importance that led Esther to win the queenship. It's that she was just really pretty and very much to the liking of the king. So he's a shallow guy, but that's the reality.
And just because of that, he was able to get that close to... was the one who brought him in then.
Correct. In other words, once Esther's in the palace, then Mordechai felt it necessary to be nearby to look out for her because she was in a very serious position. Who is allowed to go to the king's courtyard? I don't know how that works. But evidently he was able to get there without trouble. Yeah.
But how could he get there? Because no one knew that she was a Jew. So how did they know about the relationship between her and Mordechai?
Right, so he has to come up with some, you know, hey, people hang out the king's courtyard all the time. I have no idea how that worked in practice, and you're right. He certainly never tells anybody why he's there.
It wasn't because he was a member of the Sanhedrin and that he was there because, you know, like they had a Jewish liaison?
I can't tell you, no. The Megillah doesn't frame it that way, which doesn't mean that there isn't more information behind the Megillah. The Megillah just frames it as Mordechai saw to it to be there because he was looking out for his cousin. So you're right. Is there backstory? There's always backstory, right? You know, I'm all big in pshat. Like, I think you have to really pay attention to what the words are, but I don't think that the pshat is the whole story. There's always a lot more going on behind the scenes, yeah.
So, the words of Mordechai Yoshe B'Shar, I understood that, you know, he had the equivalent of the job of the executive office building.
He might have a job, or he might just hang out a lot there.
He might just hang out.
The fact that he was originally exiled by with the exile of Yechonim, doesn't that imply that he was Jewish nobility?
He probably is from a noble family.
Right.
So
therefore, he had some. So he at least carried himself with certain standing.
Oh yeah, he's great. Oh, definitely. He definitely seems to be one of the communal leaders, and the whole story kind of turns on that, right? Like when he makes an announcement to the public, everybody kind of knows who he is. He's a very widely respected and regarded individual. I'm all good with what you're saying. That doesn't necessarily by itself give access to the king's courtyard. That would just mean he would be a Jewish notable within the Jewish community. All I can tell you is he was able to sit in the king's courtyard, and that's fine. I don't know the whole detail. Yeah?
When Mordechai talks to Esther, he implies that maybe you're there for a reason, and that's why you came to the Malchut. But if he's the trigger, and he wouldn't have been there because unless she was there, I don't get that. In other words, if she weren't there, he wouldn't have been there. He wouldn't have triggered Haman to be angry at the Jews and create this whole issue.
Fine, right, so?
So how could he say that to her?
Look, he certainly believes, or at least the way he frames it. I don't know what's going on inside of his head, but at least his words are, from the moment Esther was chosen, it sounds like, you know, if you pulled Mordechai aside, what do you think, Mordechai? It's like, look, I don't know what this means yet, but God has a plan. I just don't know what that plan is. He's not allowed to say the word God because we're in the Megillah, and God just is not here. But that's what he's thinking, right? Okay, so that's basically what he's telling Esther. He's saying, okay, look, for 5 years you've been queen. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. We now see that this is fraught with purpose. Go in there and talk to your husband, right? That's his whole agenda. So you're right. You could hurl at Mordechai, well, hey, Mordechai, had you bowed, then none of this would have happened.
Nothing had you bowed, but had he not been there, it wouldn't.
Correct. That's true, but what do I tell you? He still thinks at this moment it's her obligation on behalf of the Jewish people to come to bat. Right, and that's what she does, yeah.
Why did he tell Esther to begin with not to say that she was Jewish?
Don't know. The Mefarshim debate, because it's amazingly enough, some of the most important questions in the Megillah, your point included, I haven't the foggiest clue. It's amazing that at no point does that seem to come up as to why that should be. Here are some, you want to hear a wide range of opinions? Okay. Well, some Mefarshim think Mordechai wanted her to win the queenship, but Ahasuerus probably hated Jews. So the best way to conceal her Jewishness, and then she has a better shot at winning. That's one track of our Rishonim. Another track is Mordechai doesn't want her to win because, seriously, do you want your cousin marrying this guy? He's slimy, right? So even if he's a king, it doesn't matter. He's an awful man. So Mordechai didn't want her to win, and so he wanted to conceal her noble roots so that he would be unattracted to her. Okay, so what we're talking here is we're just all making things up, right? In other words, we don't know, did Mordechai want Esther to win? Did Mordechai not want her to win? I have no idea. The Megillah doesn't say. All I know is that she was stuck. She had to go because all virgins had to go. She was really pretty and specifically to the liking of the king. That's how it all happened. I have no idea how Mordechai reacts to that at all. All I can tell you is what we were talking about before. He seems to think that there's some purpose to all of this, and that 5 years later, when the situation comes up, he gets very animated about that. So let's get back to Mordechai's refusal to bow, since that's where we were, yeah?
Yeah. The way I read this pasuk is that the answer is that the reason he didn't bow down is simply because he's a Jew, which reinforces Haman's accusation that he's not loyal. That is the reason. Jews are different.
Yeah, but why can't Jews bow?
I'm sorry?
Why can't Jews bow to Haman?
Because he's a Jew and he's different.
So?
That reinforces exactly what Haman's accusation.
But there's nothing wrong with bowing to him. Just by the way, just let you understand this. Esther bows to Ahasuerus in Parakhet, and none of us fuss whatsoever. And that's fine. She's allowed to bow to him. She's not worshiping him. She's bowing to him because that's what you do in front of the king. She's groveling. She's pleading for the Jews' lives, okay? So what you do here is you bow. That's the right thing to do. And nobody's going to say, oh my goodness, idolatry, assimilate. No, she's pleading on behalf of the Jewish people. She's doing the right thing. When Natan HaNavi bows to David HaMelech, you better believe that neither Natan nor David is thinking idolatrous thoughts. Right? You bow to the king. It's a rare moment where a prophet bows to a king. Prophets usually don't bow to anybody. But that's a function of their being prophets, right? Prophets don't bow to anybody. They stand before God and they're God's agent vis-a-vis the king. But all the same, it's not offensive when Natan HaNavi bows in front of David. It's perfectly normal. He's following court protocol given the circumstances over there. So, just Herodotus, by the way, talks about this, the great Greek historian of the ancient world. He says that actually, I'm glad that we don't have this protocol because it would just be so weird walking down the street. But if you were an ancient Persian, here's what you had to put up with. First of all, evidently, everybody had to wear a badge with what your ranking was. Because what happened was, according to Herodotus, if Persians encounter each other, if they're of the same rank, then they kiss each other on the mouth. Okay? If one is a little lower, then they kiss each other on the cheek. But if one is way lower, then the lower guy bows, just throws himself down on the ground and prostrates before the higher ranking guy. That's what you do. Right? And that was normal. Nobody's worshiping anybody. It was just a sign of respect for high officials. So the problem is immense because all the Megillah says, the only reason why Mordechai is not bowing is because it was the king's decree. But so what? Of course it's the king's decree. That's why you bow. Right? There's no, to risk your own life. Again, the idea that Mordechai would know that he would put the entire Jewish people at risk is beyond us. We don't know if he realized what great a risk he was taking for all of us. He might have, but he for sure knew. Mordechai wasn't foolish. Mordechai knew that by not bowing, if he gets caught, he can be killed for that. He's defying the king, and he knew that very, very well. Defying the king is a capital offense. Ahasuerus is not a nice guy. He would certainly kill him. And so to put himself in peril, there better be a reason for this. Better than because he's defying the king. Yeah?
I don't think anybody's going to like this, but
I hate it already. Yeah.
Okay, I'm thinking about the story of Hannah and her seven sons. And I know we're not in Hanukkah, I know we're in Purim. But they all bowed down, they refused to bow down to the king, and they were all killed. So what's that?
No, but there's idolatry involved. There's explicit idolatry in that.
Oh, yeah, there's idolatry.
Yeah, I think in that, I have to reread it. It's been a while since I've read all books of the Maccabees, but I think that there's real idols in some of these stories. I don't think it's just to the king as a king. I think that there are real statues and good old-fashioned paganism in play. And by the way, that just calls attention to our story, where paganism is absent from Megillat Esther. Again, the Persians were pagans. They worshipped idols and stuff. But that plays zero role, as in like zero role in our story. It's not about idolatry at all.
So yeah. What's all the dot that they're always referring to?
Oh, they had laws. They're
not religion.
It's not about the religion. We use the term in terms of religious law, dati, right? Mm-hmm. But dat ha-melech just means the king's laws. Mm-hmm. So this was what you and I would call civil law, right? In other words, there's no such thing as civil law back then. If the pagan emperor is making laws, okay, so there's a religious connotation to that, but it's still not Persian pagan religion as religion. That belongs to the priests. Ahasuerus is simply talking about the laws of the land, including kings cannot retract their decrees, evidently, right? Which is a real bummer for us in our story. But all the same, but that's the kind of law that we're talking about, yeah?
So is Mordechai could be feeling he's on the same rank as Haman?
Well, he's defying. No, he's defying.
Yeah, but then he's not defying the king's law. If he's on the same rank, he doesn't have to.
Maybe that's the psychology behind him. I can't tell you no. Very good. All I can tell you is it's conspicuously missing what his reasoning is. So as many of you have already noted, in source number 7 is what you're referring to. It's in a midrash. Mordechai did not bow nor prostrate himself before him. Was Mordechai then looking for quarrels or being disobedient to the king's command? Stop right here. The reason why the Midrash is asking that is because that's actually all that the text says. It's what we call Ahava Amina in Midrashic lore, right? Ahava Amina means all it says in the text is that he's defying the king. But is he really doing this just to defy the king? That cannot be, says this Midrash. The fact is that when Ahasuerus ordered that all should bow down to Haman, the latter fixed an idolatrous image on his breast for the purpose of making all bow down to an idol. Lovely. Now, I don't need to tell you that this is so far into what the text is about, it's hard to believe. You know what's fun, though? Okay, so what is Ibn Ezra going to do? Methodology moment here. All right, Ibn Ezra stakes his whole career in the 12th century about, I'm not going to impose midrashim that are far into the text onto the text. We're going to work from the text outward. All right, so what does he do here? Instructive question. You ready for this? I'll tell you what he says. So Ibn Ezra is a text man, but he's also a logic man. And to him, it is obvious that Mordechai was a good and rational individual who knew full well that he was risking his life over this. And Ibn Ezra racks his brains, and he cannot come up with any reason either because, folks, there is nothing that is evident here. So he just says, you know that midrash about the idol? I love it. That's what Ibn Ezra does here. We're talking about severe desperation. Okay, that's all we're talking about. In other words, it's so conspicuously not here. There's nothing about idolatry in our text. And Mordechai doesn't seem to have idolatry on his mind, and Haman doesn't seem to have idolatry on his mind either. It's not about idolatry. So Rav Yaakov Medan, by the way, just to give an alternative which matches the story, as opposed to idolatry which does not, Rav Yaakov Medan, the Rosh Yeshiva, or one of the Rosh Yeshivat, Yeshivat Har Etzion, posits that, you know, imagine in 1933, somebody of moral substance defying Hitler at a parade. He's going to die, or at least suffer a lot. But you know what? Bless that person for having a conscience. Somebody's got to stand up to evil. So Rav Medan says that's what Mordechai is doing here. It's not about idolatry. There's nothing about idolatry in our story. But Haman is evil. Okay, we can all agree to that, I hope. Huh? Oh, so that's correct. So it's running on the assumption that Mordechai knows enough about Haman's character. You're correct. We don't know that he's evil just yet. We're about to find out. So, but Mordechai knew him, or at least knew about him, so it could be, and that's what Rav Medan is banking on to make this work, that Mordechai was fighting against evil. And yes, he would die for that, but it was worth it. He didn't realize that he would imperil the entire Jewish people. But Mordechai was expecting to be killed. That wouldn't have been a surprise to him at all. But it's worth it. Somebody's got to stand up to a guy like Haman. That's the assumption of Rav Medan. I think it's at least a fair assumption. I think there's something else going on, and a lot of next week is going to ride on that. But we'll save next week for next week. I just want to summarize what we have going for us right now. The depiction of the Jewish people is entirely positive in Megillat Esther, and you'll never find any negative criticism, or even criticism, since that's what would make it negative. You're not going to find any criticism of the Jews. They look fabulous in the story. Bar none, right? We also have no specific reference to religious anything in Megillat Esther. Not God, not the Torah, not any ritual observance. The holiday at the end could have been totally nationalistic, and so I don't know what's going on with that. The craziest part is that we don't know why Mordechai refuses to bow. Certainly not about idolatry. Not in the text. I mean, again, if there's some backstory that we don't know about from the text, fine. But Megillat Esther certainly is not occupied with idolatry at all. So that's not what it's about. Maybe it's about evil. Maybe something else bigger is going on over there. And this should give us pause, because this is what I like in learning. Good learning is when you actually can let go of what you thought. Right? What I never am able to say this, but I can say it here in this situation because nobody said it tonight, which is good. Often enough, you give shiurim on familiar topics. It doesn't happen when you're giving shiurim on unfamiliar topics, but when you're giving it on more familiar ones, once in a while people will raise his or her hand, their hands, and they'll say, but I always thought X. And what I always want to say is, so what? Like, so what if you always thought that? That's not learning. Learning isn't what you always thought. Learning is, well, what do we think now? Right? In other words, what are we going to do given all the evidence, and can we sustain all the evidence as best as we can? I mean, we can't know all the answers, but at least are we doing a proper learning exercise? So whatever we thought about Megillat Esther, hopefully is in limbo right now. That's all I was hoping to do tonight. I said it was all going to be questions. I really did mean it, yeah?
Rabbi, any indication from the Rabbarshim as to how old Esther and Mordechai were?
People can guess all they would like, but there's no way to know, right? I mean, it's presumably Esther was to the younger end of the spectrum. Mordechai sounds like he's an older, venerable member of the community, but I'm totally just making this up. If he was a precocious 30-year-old, that's fine. Right? In other words, it sounds like he's older than that. It sounds like he's a more established individual in the community, but all the same, there's no good ways to know their ages. Right? In other words, you don't need to know me very well. I don't know is a really good answer, and it's like 99% of the time that's what the answer is going to be. Because the text often gives you very little by way of information like that, yeah. Somebody had a hand up somewhere, yeah.
One of the points that you raised earlier, two points actually. One was that if there was idol worship, it was three generations before, it was not then. And the other thing was, if in fact the Jews of Shushan were guilty of something, why should the rest of the nation suffer?
That's exactly what Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says. That's why he throws a student's answer right out.
So I always thought that...
But who cares?
I always thought that sins can carry on for $3, and you might see children carry on for $10.
Right.
That's one thing. The other thing I always thought was that sometimes the sins of the few can affect the clock.
I can't tell you any of these things. You're absolutely right. You're giving good theological justification for why one might look for a reason for the decree. I'm good with that. All I can tell you is you're trying to guess God's mind, which is a good thing to do. It's a good religious enterprise. That's what you're trying to do, right? You're trying to give some principle for divine judgment in this case. That's called guessing God's mind. That's fine. You're not only entitled to, but plenty of Mefarshim do this sort of thing. But all I can tell you, and that's all I'm trying to say, is that Megillat Esther has zero interest in that question. Zero. So that's what's important. In other words, what God is thinking, I don't know. And you're giving true trodden principles that actually do relate to the case at hand.
The other thing I want to know is, when did you reveal, this week or next week, what made you change your whole position?
Oh, next week, big time. Next week. Basically the way that I have in my head these two shiurim, and I warned John just to make it, and he loved it, so I figured, okay, I realize there's just one guy, and now you're all stuck with the consequences. Okay, but that, to me, that's the only way to do these shiurim, is to have one shiur of all question, and the next shiur is where we put it all together. Yeah, from the ground up. In other words, once we can say, man, here's the most familiar text in the world, and it's rather, I still find it rather humbling that pretty much anything that I learned ever until I read that article had to be deleted, right? That's very humbling, because I learned a lot of things and very solid, excellent sources, but zero of them had any foundation. That was what was at stake. So what I'm trying to do here is just burn everything to the foundation. For the sake of them, let's build a beautiful building on top of that, yeah.
Is it obvious that you believe that Haman the Agagi was a descendant of Amalek?
Even that's not 100% sure. It could be. Ha-Agagi, he's called Ha-Agagi five times in the Megillah. So that could mean one of two things. One, he's really from Amalek, and even possibly from, whether from King Agag, the guy that we know in Sefer Shmuel, or some other Amalekite king with the same name, maybe it was a dynastic type of name. Plausible, and even reasonable, and I don't need to tell you that whether or not that is true, the guy is Amalek, right? Whether he's biological.
I'm saying if we really do that, believe that Al-Pshat, that Agagi means an Amaleki, then Mordechai would have an immediate reason to distrust and dislike him or to
right, so that's why I'm hedging.
From his heritage point of view.
Correct. But I'm hedging because it's not clear Al-Pshat. Agag also was a very known Persian and Elamite name, so it could very well be that he was just from a prominent clan of Persia or Elam, which was a neighboring state, in which case, Megillat Esther might be playing with the name. In other words, the fact that it's calling him Ha-Agagi five times is meaningful to us. Whether or not he's from real biological Amalek, or whether Megillat Esther just wants to say, this guy is Amalek, don't you get it, he's evil, Mordechai still would react this way, because he's evil. Again, Hitler, it doesn't matter what his DNA is, vis-a-vis Amalek, that's Amalek.
If he really were, then Mordechai would have a reason to dislike him.
Yeah. But the point is that if he is that evil and Mordechai knows that he's that evil, then he has that reason to dislike him already. Yes?
You have said that three generations ago, the Jews have that to abode in Ireland.
Yes.
In the Hamash, it says that it's five, six generations after.
Very good. So this gentleman said a similar thing. So I can't tell you that this isn't what God is thinking, because in general, I don't know what God is thinking. Right? So I don't know what God is thinking here either. All I can say, and that's all the shiur is about, I try to keep it much more limited. I don't pretend to know what God thinks unless God tells us by a Navi. Then I don't need to pretend. Okay, God told us something through a Navi. I'm good with that until somebody tells me otherwise, right? All I can tell you is that Megillat Esther is utterly uninterested in this question. It's not about why the Jews deserved the destruction or why they deserved this threat. There are only three reasons, only three. Mordechai refuses to bow, Haman is evil, Ahasuerus accepts the bribe. That's it. There's nothing about God or any theological consequence for all of this. So what God is thinking is what you're trying to speculate with, which is a good thing to do. All I'm telling you is, maybe, maybe not, don't know. All I can tell you is that Megillat Esther is thoroughly not interested in this question, and that I think is important. In other words, if we're asking the question of what is Megillat Esther trying to teach, I guarantee you it is not trying to teach why the Jews deserve this. Because it doesn't say a word about that. But I can try to tell you what I think the Megillah does teach. And in order to do that, though, we had to have all these questions. And now that we're unsure about anything, well, tune in next week. And God willing, I'm going to tell you everything. And then we're going to be able to really go to it. So I look forward to doing that with you. Thank you so much again.